or die trying. Thunder growled in the distance. Greece looked up at the sky, which appeared clear as far as he could see. The thunder continued rolling toward him, getting closer. Not thunder, horses, he realized. He needed to get off the road. To the left was prairie land, and to the right, the sea. The road curled ahead around a series of large cliff-facing boulders, disappearing from sight. The hoofbeats were getting closer. He veered left, tripping twice over his own traitorous feet, before diving behind a thick bramble of brittle plants that poked his skin, drawing blood. Not a moment too soon. The Furier burst from behind the boulders, stampeding around the bend and past him, right where he'd been standing. Through the nest of branches, he watched them, their red capes flashing like sunbursts. "Shay, Shay, Shay!" He pleaded with his eyes to find her, to see her alive and breathing, carried by one of the holy warriors. The last of the Furia whipped past, and then they were gone, heading back toward Night's End. Shay wasn't with them, and there'd only been one of the three Furies riding at the front, leading her warriors. The group of Furia had seemed too small, like they'd split up, half returning to Night's End, while the remainder made for some other location. But where? Energized by the possibility that the rest of the Furia and his sister might be close, Greece fought to his feet, ignoring the spots of blood welling from his punctured skin, and returned to the road. He ran, slowly at first, but then faster, curving around the boulders, weaving right and then left as the road snaked away from him. He cleared the final obstruction and then stopped, his chest heaving, his lungs burning, his hands on his knees. The coastal road stretched onwards to the south, narrowing as it approached the horizon, and then disappearing entirely. The road was empty. 24. The Western Kingdom, Night's End. Rhea Loren. Her golden hair was greasy and flat, matted against her sweat and tear-soaked cheeks. Her dressing clothes were filthy, crusted with dried blood and evaporated rainwater, and she was missing a shoe, her naked foot, muddy and blood-stained, sticking out like a pale fish. She refused to let the thin old man anywhere near her, even when he offered her clean clothes. "Don't touch me!" she'd screamed, as he'd corralled her into his boot shop and up the stairs to his living quarters. She knew she wasn't being fair to the kindly man, but the thought of being touched made her skin crawl with thousands of spiders. He was back now, and she couldn't help but to shrink against the wall, hugging her knees to her chest. "Name's Vaughan. Well, Jordan Vaughan, but everyone just calls me Vaughan." He crinkled his eyes and tried to smile, but it came out forced. "Your Highness, I mean," he added. Rhea tried to speak, but all that came out was a croak. Her father collapsed in her mind, bloody and lifeless. Again and again and again. She hadn't liked him most of the time, but she had loved him. Some called him harsh, some a tyrant. But he'd been a man of principle, as unfaltering in his beliefs as anyone she'd ever met. "Who could have killed so many guards, and then him?" Rhea wondered. It was impossible. Night's End was a fortress. "I brought you some soup," Vaughan said. He stepped forward, and Rhea tried to push herself through the wall. "Don't be scared. I won't hurt you. Won't touch you. Soup's thin, probably not what you're accustomed to eating, but it'll help some. Gotta get your strength back." Rhea just stared at him, wishing him away. Wishing Greece would come back and hold her, protect her, the way he had as they fled the castle. He never would. Not after what she had done to him and his sister. A thought occurred to her. This is punishment. She'd sinned against Roth, and, just like her father and his priestesses had warned her entire life, their god had brought a fist down like a hammer. Her lack of faith, her lies, her sneaking around and fornicating with a boy she barely knew, a boy she desired all the more because he was a sinner like her. She'd done this. She was sure of it. Vaughan squatted and placed the bowl on the floor, pushing it toward her.
I'll be back to check on you in a few hours. Already got a few customers awaiting.
He moved to leave, but she managed to croak out,
Wait.
He stopped, turned, his scraggly eyebrows pushing toward his brow. Waited.
Thank you,
she said. He nodded and left, his boots clumping down the stairs. She stared at the bowl, the surface of the soup like brown glass. Her decisions had ruined so many things. Greasy's hand, his sister's secret, her father. She should take the scalding hot soup and dump it over her own head. She should find a knife and stab it into her chest. She should... Tears streaked down her cheeks. She knew she wouldn't do any of those things. It was her emotions that had caused all the trouble in the first place. Staring at the soup, it felt like the most important decision of her life. And then she reached for it.
Take me back to the castle, Rhea said.
Startled, Vaughn turned to look at her. He was sitting at a wooden desk, stitching several thick folds of leather together. One finished boot already lay on the slab in front of him. The one he was working on would be its pair. Even from across the room, she could tell the workmanship was excellent.
Please,
she added, remembering her manners. He looked her up and down, taking in the ill-fitting but clean clothes he'd given her, a white frock of purity that must have belonged to a woman twice her size and half her height.
"'Twas my wife's cloak," he said. "Wore it to the temple every day."
Rhea didn't want to ask what had happened to his wife. She couldn't take more talk of death. Not now.
"Thank you. I will return it as soon as I've had it laundered. Now please escort me back."
"The castle isn't safe," Vaughn said.
"You should hear the rumours. Ghosts and goblins, and even worse things that'll make your spine tingle."
"I know. I was there. I saw the worst things. I have to find my brother, my sister. They'll be scared. I'm the eldest. It's my duty."
She never cared about her twin siblings before. The spoiled brats practically ran the castle. She could hide her face with the frock, head south, try to find Greece, Grey. Maybe help him rescue his sister. It was one way she could make up for what she'd done. But she'd already made a choice.
"I'll go on my own if I have to," she said.
Vaughn chewed on his dry lips for a moment.
"I'll take you. Give me two licks."
Without another word, he went back to work on the half-finished boot, his fingers agile and well-practiced as the shoe began to take shape. Rhea slowly made her way over to him, but kept her distance, watching over his shoulder. He finished a few minutes later and held both boots up next to each other, examining them for defects.
"Perfect,"
was the only word Rhea could think of to describe them. And they were. The boots had solid black heels, tight, tiny stitches securing them to the black leather sides. Gold stitching formed an ornate depiction of the rearing stallion, the royal sigil, on each boot.
"You like 'em?"
Vaughn said, looking at her expectantly.
"Yes. How could I not?"
she said.
"They're yours,"
he said, extending his arms and the boots toward her. She frowned.
"But you're a customer. I made them for you."
"But I have..."
She stopped and looked down at her feet. She'd lost one slipper in the castle and discarded the other one upstairs.
"I will pay you a fair price," she said. "My father?"
She swallowed thickly.
"The royal treasurer will make sure you receive a royal compensation."
She hoped he was still alive. Vaughn shook his head.
"They are a gift."
Rhea shook her head, confused.
"They are beautiful, but I can't accept such a gift."
"They're fit for a princess, don't you think?"
"Yes, but..."
"And you're a princess, no?"
"Yes, but then they're yours, and I won't hear another word about it."
Vaughn stood and handed her the boots, and this time she didn't back away. She'd never met a man so genuinely kind.
"Thank you. I shall repay you in spades some day."
"Your smile is repayment enough for me," he said.
Rhea had to reach up to touch her cheeks to confirm she was actually smiling. Her lips drooped and the smile vanished.
"Well, I will send business from the castle your way all the same."
"After you, princess," he said,
waving her toward his shop door. As they left, he hung a sign on the door and locked it behind him. Rhea pulled the droopy white hood over her head and around her face.
"Princesses don't need to hide," Fawn said. "You will be safe with me."
She reached up and grabbed the edge of the hood, but she couldn't do it. Within the cocoon of fabric, she could only see straight ahead. She could focus on the road stretching before her, on her feet marching one in front of the other. But if she pulled it back, too much information would flood in, and then would come the horrors from the night before.
"Left foot, right foot, left foot,"
she chanted in her mind, ignoring the greetings hollered at Vaughan as he passed, ignoring the hustle and bustle of the city, which she used to love, ignoring the brightly coloured fruits on the stands on either side, focusing on only one thing, walking. The castle gates loomed ahead, and a slice of fear seemed to open her up from skull to feet, leaving her exposed, vulnerable. She stopped. Vaughan said,
"Princess?"
She breathed, in and out, in and out. Her heart, her mind, and her gut all urged her to turn, to run, to flee the castle that had once been a haven, a home, now a living nightmare.
"Left foot, right foot," she thought,
but they wouldn't obey, frozen in place, like stubborn mules overloaded with sacks of potatoes.
"We can go back to my shop,"
Vaughan said. It was a kind, generous offer, but not one she could accept. The kingdom needed her, and maybe she needed the kingdom, she wasn't sure. She opened her mouth, closed it, opened it again. Spoke, mustering as much strength and courage as she could.
"Thank you, Vaughan, for everything. I will see that you are rewarded for your kindness. You are a good man, and I know wrath smiles upon you."
It was something she had heard her father say once. She knew she sounded too formal, too rehearsed, but the facade was a shield, protecting her from the emotions welling up inside her. She was a princess.
"No. I am the queen," she whispered.
"Your highness?"
Vaughan said, tapping a finger to his ear.
"Nothing," Rhea said. "Just thank you. Goodbye."
Though her heart tried to slam through her chest, though her breath stuck in her throat, though her legs felt wobbly and detached from her body, Rhea threw back her oversized hood, lifted her chin, and marched through the gates, which stood wide open and unguarded.
"Because the guards are dead,"
Rhea reminded herself.
"But did any survive?"
Inside there was a flurry of solemn activity. Castle maids rushed hither and thither, carrying pails full of soapy water and brushes. Several were scrubbing at crimson stains on the ground. More than one were sobbing as they worked. A large wooden cart was piled up with... Rhea looked away, swallowing bile, her mouth watering, her head pounding. The bodies were stacked like goods about to be unloaded and delivered to the royal kitchens. Dead eyes stared in random directions. She swore several had been looking at her. The castle walls seemed to close in around her as nightmarish images rushed through her head. She bit the inside of her mouth and refused to vomit. She couldn't show weakness, not when the kingdom was broken in half and leaderless.
"Wrath," Rhea thought, "give me strength to do my duty."
She said loudly, "Stop!" At first, no one seemed to hear her, still moving, still cleaning, still loading the cart with the dead. But then, at once, everything froze, and all eyes moved to her.
"Princess Rhea?"
one woman, a maid, said, standing.
"Is it you? We thought you to be dead."
Her cheeks were streaked with moisture.
"Queen Lorraine,"
Rhea said. acutely aware of how ridiculous she must look in Vaughan's wife's old purity gown.
"And not but Roth himself could kill me. As you were."
Stunned, the woman didn't seem to understand, but then fumbled to her brush, dropped to her knees, and continued her work.
"Left foot, right foot."
Rhea moved forward toward the entrance to the atrium, where her father had been. She marched directly over where he'd collapsed, the marble floor already scrubbed to a perfect shine, the king's body removed. Someone rushed from the side and gripped her arm. She flinched visibly and struggled against the force.
"Rhea, it's me. Your cousin. Ennis."
Rhea stopped struggling, taking in the form of her youngest cousin, who was still 25 years her elder. His shaggy blonde hair had streaks of grey, and his cheeks were covered in rough stubble. Growing up, Ennis, who had been named after their grandfather, King Ennis Loren, had been her favourite of her 5 cousins, always willing to play with her or amuse her with silly jokes. She fell into his arms, relishing the strength and warmth they provided.
"Roth is good," Ennis said,
his pale blue eyes fierce.
"We thought you—"
"I'm not,"
Rhea said, pulling back.
"I'm here."
She rapidly brushed the tears from her cheeks. She couldn't afford them right now.
"Yes, you are,"
Ennis said, taking in her strange garb, but not commenting on it.
"I'm sorry. Your father—"
"Where did they take him?"
Rhea asked.
"You need not concern—"
"Tell me."
Ennis stared at her for a moment, and then nodded.
"He's in his chambers. They are preparing his body for its final rest in the crypts. Only then can his soul make its way to the 7th heaven.
"Good. Thank you."
Her next question hung on the tip of her tongue, as if afraid to jump off and be asked.
"What of B and Leo?"
"Roth, I should have started with news of them. They are fine, unharmed. Their chamber guards were killed while the prince and princess slumbered."
"Strange."
It seemed that everyone but the royal guards and the king had been spared. But why? She refocused on her cousin.
"And my guards? How many are left?"
Ennis frowned.
"Right now you need to rest, to mourn, to—"
"I'm the queen,"
Rhea said.
"I need to hold court. There are decisions to be made. Our forces must be renewed, our defences strengthened. The North will—"
"Queen?"
Ennis interrupted.
"Yes, legally you are. But you are only 16 and have not been anointed."
"And of sufficient age to rule, under Western law,"
Rhea said.
"My brother has already been deemed King Temporanus,"
Ennis said. He meant Jove, Rhea knew. Jove was the eldest of her cousins, near on half a century in age. Had his father, Rhea's uncle, Ty Loren, lived a few years longer, Jove would have been king rather than Gil Loren. As it was, Ty died in an unfortunate hunting accident before his father, King Ennis Loren, was taken by Roth. Thus, the kingship had fallen to Rhea's father, diverting from Jove and his 4 siblings, of which Ennis II was the last.
"By whom?"
Rhea said, her eyes narrowing. Like all of the lords and ladies of Knight's End, she'd been educated in Western law and royal politics from a young age. It felt good to discuss something technical, something that would take her mind off of everything else.
"The Furia,"
Ennis said.
"The Furia are gone,"
Rhea said.
"They took Greece's sister. No, Grey's sister. He'd called himself Grey. And he has gone after them."
She shook the thought away, trying to concentrate.
"Some of them returned. Half, perhaps. And one of the 3.
Roth,"
Rhea thought. This was unexpected. But it didn't change anything.
"They don't have the authority to make such a decision."
"With you missing, they did,"
Ennis said.
"Missing? Did anyone even look for me?"
Ennis threw up his hands in mock surrender.
"I'm just the messenger."
"But do you think they're right? Should Jove be King Temporanus?"
She held her breath, her cousin's opinion important to her. Ennis seemed to really consider it for a minute, and then laughed.
"That arrogant bastard! I'd rather a Southron monkey be king. If you plan to make a bid for the crown, I will support you."
Rhea took a deep breath. Before, she felt it was her duty to return, to rule, to help the West survive whatever was about to come. But now, she had an out. Jove could rule until she was older, when she'd had a chance to sort things out in her mind. Everything could go back to normal, with her a princess of the court, free to do as she wished. The temptation was so strong she almost grabbed it with both hands. Almost.
"I will be queen," Rhea said.
Cousin Jove was a gruff man with cold blue eyes and a smile that never reached them. No matter the nature of his expression, he always seemed to be calculating something, or trying to determine a weakness in those around him. Growing up, Rhea had never liked him, and he seemed to view children as something akin to toe fungus.
"Thank Roth you are alive," Jove said now.
Though his words were similar to those of Ennis when he first saw Rhea, there was nothing of substance behind them, and he certainly didn't step down from the throne to embrace her.
"You're in my seat," Rhea said.
B, who had refused to leave Rhea's side since they'd been reunited, snickered. Leo howled. For once, the twins seemed to be on her side, worried the castle would be taken away from them. Cousin Jove, however, did not laugh, his lips trembling in anger.
"The Furia have—" "With all due respect, brother," Ennis chimed in, "the Furia only have legal authority in the event that the heir to the throne is not of sufficient age."
Rhea spared a thankful look to her cousin.
"Thank you, my dear brother, but Rhea is just a child. You cannot possibly support what she is suggesting."
He was flanked by his remaining siblings, each somewhere between Jove and Ennis in age. Sai, his chestnut hair neatly trimmed, seemed fully in agreement with his older brother, while Wheaton appeared bored. He kept eyeing the door like he'd rather be anywhere but in court. Gaia, with her piercing green eyes, had her arm linked with Ennis's. The two youngest, they'd always been close, and Rhea was certain she would have her support. Not that it mattered. She was queen, no matter what anyone said.
"I am a woman flowered," Rhea said. "I've been a princess of the court for the last 3 years, and I am of age."
A sharp voice slashed from the shadows in the corner of the room.
"You consorted with a criminal."
Rhea jerked to the side, where one of the three Furies had appeared, almost as if she'd stepped out of the wall. Her crimson dress flowed around her muscled frame like a flickering candle. Her attractiveness was undeniable, but severe, in the same way that a well-forged sword was appealing.
"Not here," Jove said. "This is a private matter."
Rhea knew he didn't mean it, and was only pretending to care about her reputation.
"Are the sins of a princess, of a queen, private?"
the Fury said.
"No, never. Our ruler must be held to Roth's highest standard, as your father knew too well."
Anger boiled inside of Rhea.
"Do not speak of him like you knew him. He was my father."
"Do you deny my accusations, then?"
Rhea knew she was caught in a trap, and a dangerous one. She tried to meet the Fury's eyes, but found her gaze dancing back to Jove's stern expression.
"I am the one who brought the thief to justice only yesterday, and I uncovered a sin mark borne by his sister in the process. And I hate myself for it," she added in her own head.
The Fury glided closer, as if carried by the air itself.
"Yes, I remember. And yet, something about your story didn't—"
she licked her lips—
"taste right. It's amazing what a simple threat from Roth can do to loosen a person's tongue."
Rhea shuddered, trying to hide her fear by saying,
"I do not know what you speak of. Now, as your queen, I command you—"
"You cannot command Roth," the Fury growled.
You have been accused by 3 witnesses, all of whom will swear to your affair with the very same thief you brought to justice.
You have no!
Rhea screamed, but her response was swallowed by the stream of words from the Fury.
Sinned against your family, your kingdom, and yourself. You will confess your sins and be punished. Until Wrath's warriors have found you repentant and contrite, you will be denied the throne. In the meantime, your cousin, Jove, has been appointed King Temporanus and will reign in your stead.
I'm sorry, Rhea said. I swear it.
Too late, the Fury said. Take her away.
The dam burst, and Rhea couldn't hold back the tears any longer. The strength she'd fooled herself into believing that she had ripped apart like wet parchment, and, if not for Ennis's steadying hand on her elbow, she would have collapsed. Several Furia marched into court and grasped Rhea's arms, pulling her away from Ennis. She cried and bucked, but they were too strong, and she was only a girl, a child, just like Jove had said.
"I'm sorry, Father. I was weak. I ruined your good name. I failed you."
The thought of her dead father pushed even more tears from her eyes, flooding her vision. Somewhere behind her, she heard Bea and Leo screaming her name, but not because they wanted her to come back, not when it was followed by another word, a word that pierced the very fabric of her soul.
"Whore!"
they shouted in unison. Rhea was terrified. She'd been stripped naked by the Furia, forced to hug herself against the chill inside the Temple of Confession.
"I'm a queen!"
she'd screamed as they tore off the white frock, ripping it in several places. They even took her boots, the beautiful gift from Vaughn, leaving her with nothing but her regrets and sadness. The Furia refused to speak to her, and if she tried to stand, they roughly knocked her down. She was covered in bruises. Somewhere without the temple, a deep, booming bell tolled. The royal funeral bell. All of Night's End was being hailed to mourn her father's death.
"Please,"
she begged.
"I have to be there when they inter him. Please."
The 6 strong, terrifying women wouldn't even look at her. The door opened and the Fury entered. Rhea stood, but was immediately pushed back down. She laced her hands together in supplication.
"Please,"
she said.
"I have sinned. I am sorry. I repented to Wrath and received the warmth of forgiveness."
"You have received nothing," the woman said.
In one of her hands, something glinted. A knife, of a kind Rhea had seen many times before. A holy knife, blessed with pure water, untouched by human hands. She stared at it in horror. That was when she realized exactly what Greece had been through, because of her. Had that same knife been used to amputate his hand?
"Bind her,"
the Fury commanded.
"Please,"
Rhea whimpered, her voice that of a weak child. Pathetic.
"Whore,"
her siblings had cried. Were they right? She'd loved Greece, Grey, hadn't she? She'd wanted to run away with him. She scurried back, her bare skin scraping against the stone floor. Furia surrounded her. Fight as she tried, she was nothing against their strength and numbers. They easily bound her with thick rope, so she couldn't move her feet or hands. On each side of her, they held her down. The holy knife slid toward her face, and she screamed. 25. The Northern Kingdom, near Gearhead. Anis Garrick. The knights were from Castle Hill, Anis gathered, as she listened through the wood. And, of course, they were searching for her and Taryn, as well as Sir Dietrich and Archer.
What if they intercepted the stream we sent last night? What if they cracked the code? What if they already know we're here?
They were trapped in a mountain of timber, with only a man who clearly hated them to keep them safe. The farmer, Killorn, said,
"I plan to sell me goods at Gearhead."
"You're not worried about being so close to Raider's Pass? The war could easily spill into the city."
A man has got to eat. And I've lived with the threat of war my whole life. Wars are for kings, not men like me.
And you haven't seen anyone on the road? One of the knights, a man who introduced himself as Sir Vey, asked.
Nay, naught but me horse and the ice fairies.
He chuckled at his own wit.
Ice fairies were the mythological creatures northerners blamed whenever something went wrong.
The knights didn't laugh.
We have to search your wagon, another of the knights said, his voice deeper than the first.
Sir MacGarry, he'd called himself. Anise found Terin's hand and squeezed it in the dark. Terin squeezed back, twice.
It's going to be fine,
he seemed to be saying. She remembered the way he'd defeated the four royal guardsmen, brutalizing them in the process. The anger and violence and bloodlust in his eyes as he began to choke the life out of the very man who was now protecting them.
Search away,
Killorn said, almost gleefully, like it was exactly the command he was hoping to hear.
He wants us to get caught,
Anise thought. Heavy boots crunched in the snow, approaching from the side of the cart. Someone tapped on the wood with something metallic. A sword, most likely.
Me timber is the finest in the four kingdoms, Killorn bragged.
You've had the chance to compare to Southron timber,
Sir Vey mocked. More tapping, getting closer to where their empty crawl space was located.
Nay, but I've heard the southerners build their dwellings from sandstone and mortar,
Killorn said.
Their trees are too thin and scraggly to produce true timber.
The knight didn't respond, because he was too busy tapping his sword against the wood. Tap, 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 toop. The sword sounded strange when it hit the wood close to them, vibrating through. He tried again, with the same result.
"Is this a different sort of wood?"
he asked. Anise held her breath, waiting for the farmer to give them up. He didn't.
"Aye, you have a good ear. That there is blue spruce."
Anise knew he was lying, because all the trees in the farmer's forest had been the same. He was lying for them. She exhaled slowly, quietly.
"It looks the same as the rest."
"Are you a lumberman now?"
Killorn said. There was a long silence, and Anise just about died, not being able to see what was happening. But then Sir Vey laughed loudly, and there was the sound of a hand slapping a back.
"You could be a court jester,"
the knight said.
"May I see you in frozen hell some day, old man?"
With that, the boots crunched away, a horse whinnied, and hoofbeats plodded into the distance. Silence fell, and Anise waited for the farmer to run after the knights, to shout for them to return. Instead, she only heard a whisper through the timber.
"A close call, aye?"
Killorn said.
"Thank you,"
Terin said, his deep voice rumbling.
"You are a good man."
"Good man? Don't know about that. My wife's always called me a fool. Maybe she's right."
"You are no fool," Anise said. "You have proven that."
"Just don't waste it," Killorn said. "Don't let them catch you."
"I won't,"
Anise promised. The wagon lurched to a start and lumbered forward once more. The next time the wagon stopped was when it reached Gearhead. Anise had never been to the border castle, because her father refused to let her or her brother leave Castle Hill. A zing of excitement crackled through her, along with a shiver of fear. This wasn't the way she'd hoped to see the world. Hidden within a timber cart, on the run from her uncle, her parents both dead. The boards above them slid away, and an inky grey shadow crept in. Night had fallen over the north, the stars and dueling moons shrouded by clouds pregnant with unreleased snow. It was a typical northern night. A hand reached into the alcove and Anise took it. Killorn pulled her up and onto the stacked timber. She towered over the small man, who she could practically fit inside her torso.
"Thank you," she said.
"And please pass along my thanks to your wife as well."
"Thanks don't feed our hungry mouths," the man said.
But Anise could tell he was pleased by her response. He didn't reach down to help Terin, but the big man easily pulled himself out on his own. He echoed her niece's thanks, but Killorn was already clambering back into his seat and grasping the reins. He glanced back.
"You don't know my name," he said by way of goodbye.
"No,"
Anise said.
"No, we don't."
Terin had already climbed from the cart, and he reached up to help her. She started to descend the icy lumber, holding one of his hands for support. Her feet began to slide, and she got the airy feeling in her stomach of falling, but then Terin was there, holding her around the waist and slowing her descent. She landed softly on her feet, his hands on both of her hips. In that moment, she knew how the reedy, lithe castle dancers must feel all the time. She tried to pull away.
"Thank you, sir," she said.
"My pleasure, princess."
His hands hadn't left her hips, though she no longer needed them to steady her. Her face felt warm, despite the cold. The cart rattled away, but she didn't watch it go. Time felt frozen, the clouds unmoving, the wind pausing, her breath lingering in her lungs.
"We must find shelter,"
Anise said, breaking the spell. Terin's hands dropped, and he peered down the empty, narrow street Killorn had left them in. It was an alley of sorts, running between tightly packed stone buildings.
"We cannot count on the kindness of strangers here," he said.
"Why not?"
"Kindness left this city years ago," Terin said. "War does that to a place."
It was an awful thing, but Anise had never really thought about the rest of the Northern Realm. Her entire life, she'd been so focused on how much she hated Castle Hill, with its prison-like walls and shadowy corridors and grumpy lords and ladies, that she'd forgotten how much worse it would be to live in one of the border cities, with the constant threat of invasion from the east or west. She was a selfish ice-licker.
"You've been here before."
"Twice," Terin said,
leading her down the side of the alley that appeared slightly darker.
"Once to recruit soldiers to help defend the Razor, and once because my captain desired to visit the famed Gearhert pleasure houses."
"Oh,"
Anise said, her cheeks on fire.
"And did they live up to their reputation?"
Terin chuckled.
"I wouldn't know, princess. My job was to guard the door. All I know is that we had to eventually carry the captain out. He was as drowsy as a hibernating ice bear."
Anise laughed at that, glad for the levity. Terin pushed a finger to his mask, cutting her off. The sound of singing and merriment arose, coming closer. They huddled in the shadows, peering out onto a grey road. Several soldiers stumbled past, holding each other up, as well as several ill-clothed women. They sang with voices so slurred and out of tune that they belonged in the deepest depths of frozen hell.
"We drink until we're drunk. We sing until we're sunk. We think until we've thunk. We stink until we've stunk."
On the last word, they broke into a gale of laughter and stumbled onwards, pushing through a door and into a tavern. Anise remembered the day her brother had learned the silly song from one of the castle guardsmen. He'd sung it all day long, until she'd finally threatened to beat it out of his head. He'd only laughed and launched into another round. Despite the way he'd abandoned her to Terin and the howling tundra, she missed him.
"Arch, are you here somewhere?"
"Pull your hood around your face,"
Terin said.
"Follow the main road north until you reach the Laughing Mammoth Inn. It's a tavern owned by a friend of your aunt's."
"Netta?"
"Aye."
"Why are you telling me this?"
"Because you have to go alone."
Anise frowned.
"Where will you be?"
"Close. Watching. I can't be seen with you. Not here. We will be too conspicuous as a pair, especially because of how I look."
Anise held back a laugh.
"True. You do sort of stick out like a frostbitten toe. Will Archer be hiding in the tavern?"
"I cannot say for certain," Terin said. "But if Sir Dietrich passed through Gearhert, that's where he would have hidden your brother."
Anise frowned.
"It's been nigh on 7 days since we've seen them.
Would they really linger in the city that long?
Perhaps. Perhaps not. But the innkeeper will be able to tell us either way.
Anise had little other choice, having no knowledge of Gearhart or its people.
Fine. You will meet me at the tavern?
Yes, Terran confirmed. It's not far. Whistle if you need me.
Anise peeked left and then right. The streets were eerily empty, though she could hear the muffled sound of revelry forcing its way through several closed doors. She turned northward, striding with a purpose through the empty streets, pulling her woolen hood tight around her face. Gearhart wasn't dissimilar from Castle Hill, with its stone structures and snow-packed streets. An odd thrill ran through her, walking alone in this foreign city, the chilly night air making her feel as alive as she'd ever felt. The feeling vanished as she saw a shadow ahead, approaching.
Frozen hell, she thought. What now? Would it be a castle guard?
With her luck, it would be a knight. She was wrong on both accounts. It was just a man, his gait slightly off. He held a flask in each hand, alternating them as he took long swigs of whatever poison he'd chosen. Though Anise refused to look directly at him, she could tell when he spotted her, his movements slowing. She ducked her head and veered to the right, trying to put as much space between them as possible. He mimicked her movement in reverse, angling toward her. Anise immediately thought of Terran, stalking her movements somewhere else, watching over her. It didn't make her feel safer. It made her scared for this man, who was clearly drunk and not thinking clearly.
"Come here, woman,"
the man slurred.
"I won't bite."
He cackled and nearly tripped.
"Leave me, sir," Anise said. "Please, Terran, don't get involved."
"Sir? Ha! My lady has good manners. Who do you think you are, a princess of the north?"
More cackling. He tucked the flasks into a hidden pocket in his thick coat. His hands free, he groped for her, but she squirmed away.
"I said, leave me alone,"
Anise repeated, slapping his outstretched hands away.
"Whistle if you need me."
Anise gritted her teeth instead.
"Ah, that's more like it," the man said, undeterred. "I like a little fire in my women. And war is coming, don't you hear? This could be our last night alive. Shouldn't we spend it with each other's company?"
Anise could hear the sound of heavy footsteps racing toward them.
"No,"
she thought. Impulsively, she grabbed the man by the collar and shoved him back. He stumbled, landing on his arse.
"Bitch," he spat.
"Drunk bastard,"
she growled in response, kicking him between the ribs. He groaned and rolled over. A moment later, he was snoring. The heavy footfalls slowed to a stop. Anise whirled around to find Terran staring at her, his fingers curling and uncurling at his sides, his chest heaving. She turned away and continued on without a word. The drunken fool would wake up the next morning with not more than a headache and a chill, not knowing a runaway princess had saved his miserable, meaningless life. The Laughing Mammothin was impossible to miss. A huge frosted sign hung over the door, a large depiction of a tusked mammothin bearing a wide smile displayed beneath the tavern's name. The door swung open as Anise approached, and three women emerged, trading quips about their husbands. Too caught up in their own conversation, they didn't seem to notice Anise as she slipped past and through the entrance. The first thing she felt was the warmth, which hit her in the face like a hot wind. Fires crackled in three separate hearths. Ivory tusks were mounted in several places on the walls, the largest above a long stone counter where patrons sat, eating, drinking, and talking. The second thing Anise noticed was that every person inside the tavern was female. Before she could consider this strange fact, a voice said,
"Clean your feet and come on in."
A woman beckoned from behind the bar, waving Anise forward. She wore a furry brown apron and a smile almost as warm as the atmosphere. Anise obeyed, stomping the snow and ice from her boots and snaking past round tables, most of which were empty, cluttered with used dishes. Anise sniffed the air. Something smelled good.
"Come hungry,"
Netta had responded the day before. The hunger monster in her stomach tried to claw its way through her skin.
"Welcome to the Laughing Mammoth, then," the woman said. "I'm Netta, and this is my place."
The tavern's proprietor had grey hair piled in a bun atop her head.
"Where are all the men?"
Anise asked, unable to stop herself.
"Women only," Netta said. "You want men? Try Deep Freeze, Howling Wind, or the White Lantern. You're not from around here."
Anise concocted a quick lie, just in case the other women in the tavern were untrustworthy. She could pull Netta aside later and explain she was the blooming hope flower Terin had streamed her about yesterday.
"I grew up along the Snake River, east of Castle Hill. My father's a fisherman."
"And your mother?"
"She's dead. She was a beautiful queen from the west."
"A damn good cook,"
Anise said. Netta laughed, and several other women turned to stare.
"She must have been an impressive woman," Netta said.
"That she was,"
Anise said, her heart skipping a beat. The women at the bar made room and offered an empty stool.
"Mammoth and stew?"
Netta asked.
"It's the house specialty."
"Aye,"
Anise said.
"Thank you."
The woman on her left, a dark-haired bruiser with the shadow of a moustache over her upper lip, said,
"You're young."
20,
Anise lied. The woman on her right, whose lips were as pink as a hope flower in spring, said,
"Are you travelling alone?"
"Sort of,"
she said.
"I have a companion, but he's not always around."
"Ah,"
the women sighed in unison.
"A soldier, then. He's gone to Raiders Pass."
Anise didn't respond, tucking into her stew the moment Netta slid it in front of her. The concoction was thick and hot and hell-frozen delicious. The women watched her as she gobbled it down, wiping her chin with the back of her hand.
"I take it you like it,"
Netta said, smiling.
"You made this?" Anise asked.
Netta nodded. The moustached woman beside Anise said,
"It's famous. The men of Gearhead have been trying to sneak inside for years to get some."
Anise pushed her bowl back toward Netta, who refilled it using a deep ladle.
"I've never heard of a ladies-only tavern," she admitted.
"Probably, 'cause I'm the only one," Netta said.
"Doesn't it anger the men?"
Anise barely managed to ask, before returning to the fresh bowl of stew. She scalded her tongue with the first bite, but she didn't care.
"That's half the fun of it," Netta said. "But they have their roughshod taverns and pleasure houses, so why shouldn't we have a place of our own?"
Anise had never thought of it that way, but it made sense.
"What of your husband?"
Anise asked, between mouthfuls.
"Dead,"
Netta said, bluntly.
"I'm sorry,"
Anise said. She stopped eating for a moment, out of respect.
"Don't be,"
Netta said.
"He was a mean bastard who liked to hit me if his soup got cold. I hope he freezes in hell."
Anise gaped, but then the other women laughed, and she couldn't hold back her own smile. She'd never met women like this, so strong-willed, independent and confident. They seemed to have much more texture than the sanded-down ladies of Castle Hill.
"Finish your stew and you can have dessert,"
Netta said.
"I just made tickleberry pie today, and there's still a couple of slices left over."
Anise almost fainted. It was like she'd gone to the Western Kingdom's seventh heaven and these women were angels. She slurped the last morsels out of her spoon and her bowl was whisked away. While she waited for pie, she asked casually,
"Do you know a knight named Sir Dietrich?"
Netta's hand froze in place, gooey tickleberry filling dripping from the end of a flat serving spatula. She dropped the utensil and spun around, her eyes suddenly dark.
"Who in the frozen hell are you?"
she said. The other women pushed off of their stools and surrounded her.
"No one,"
she said.
"I'm just
Queen Anise Gehrig,"
a stern voice said.
"Once a princess of Castle Hill, and now the rightful heir to the northern throne."
Anise knew that voice, and she craned her neck to see past the circle of women who parted in the centre. A cloaked form emerged from a corner table, wreathed in shadows. She threw back her hood and grinned.
"Aunt Zelda,"
Anise said. The first thing her aunt did was steal her pie. The second thing she did was threaten the tavern women with violent dismemberment if any of them so much as breathed a word of Anise's presence outside of the establishment. They all readily agreed to the secret, and Anise could tell they meant to keep the promise.
"I was pleased when Netta received Terran's stream yesterday afternoon," Zelda said,
when the women had departed and the tavern doors were locked. Only Netta remained, busying herself with cleaning the tables and gathering bowls and glasses.
"I thought everyone wanted me to go to Blackstone."
Zelda grinned.
"I want you to blaze your own path, as I have always done."
Anise didn't think her brother would agree. Still, he was her kin, and she longed to be reunited with him.
"Where is Arch?"
she asked.
"He was here," Zelda said, taking a large bite of pie.
"And now?"
"Gone south, to Raiders Pass."
Anise's heart sank.
"Why?"
"He felt his best chance at exerting his right to the crown would be with the soldiers closest to the front lines. I agreed."
Anise remembered how her aunt had referred to her as Queen Anise Garrick.
"You know I have passed my 18th name day," she said.
"Yes."
"And yet you let Arch go south. People are saying war is coming."
"Yes, I let him go, because his decisions are not mine to make, no more than yours are. And yes, the front lines have been quiet for several months, but now the streams are saying there's an Eastern Legion marching north toward the pass."
"Why didn't you tell him I'm the ruler by law?"
Her aunt didn't answer, asking a question of her own.
"What do you plan to say to your brother when you see him?"
After spending only a little time with the strong women patrons of the Laughing Mammothine, she found herself embarrassed to tell her aunt the truth. But she couldn't lie.
"I plan to relinquish the crown."
Zelda nodded, as if unsurprised by her response.
"You're so much like your mother," she said.
Anise's heart fluttered.
The statement was so much like what Terrin had said that it was eerie. "How?"
"Your mother hated the power the most. She hated Castle Hill and all that it stood for. It was her prison, and she longed to escape from it."
"I know she did,"
Anise said, feeling suddenly cold inside. She had felt the same way about Castle Hill her entire life, though she'd never thought of how that gave her and her mother something in common. Zelda nodded thoughtfully.
"The only thing that kept her going was her children. You. Arch."
Anise shook her head.
"No, you're wrong. She hated us because we're Garricks. She hated that our father was in us. She barely looked at me.
At least until the very end. Just before she was..."
"It was an act. Your father was a bad man. He only knew one way to rule, fear. He ruled his household the same way. His wife, your mother, knew this. He was willing to threaten her into obedience with anything and anyone she cared about."
"Wait, did that mean she pretended to hate us, to protect us?"
Zelda nodded, her pale complexion almost moon-like, as the room darkened when Netta began extinguishing the fires in each hearth.
"He would have hurt you to hurt Sabria."
It was suddenly all too much for Anise. She stirred quickly, her stool clattering to the floor. Her mother's love was all she ever wanted, and then, when she finally received it,
gone.
It was gone forever.
"Still, thank you for telling me," she said. "But it doesn't change anything. She's still dead, and I still hate the North."
Zelda nodded again.
"That's what Sabria said. She wanted a different life for you, for your brother. She asked me to give it to you, and I agreed."
"What life?"
Anise leaned closer, desperate to learn about the mother she never really knew.
"Away from here, from these lands, from the war. She wanted me to arrange for you to sail to Crimea, where you could start over.
You said you agreed with her. Then why are we here?
Because I lied.
Zelda's eyes met Anise's, dark and piercing. Anise stared right back.
I won't be queen, she said. And Arch is too young to be king. He's only 16. You have to fulfill the promise you made to my mother. You have to help us get to Crimea.
Is that what you want?
The question took her by surprise, because she'd never been asked it before. Not by her father or her mother. Or even Arch, who forced her to go with Taryn when she wanted to go with him.
Does it matter what I want?
It's the only thing that matters, Zelda said, her eyes twinkling.
26. The Eastern Kingdom, Norris. Rhone. Norris was a well-fortified town on the eastern edge of the Snake River, just north of Hyro Lake. The town's double wall was constructed of felled trees from the Tangle, a thick forest across the waters separating the east from the west. The trees were then bound together with metal wire, channeled by skilled Orions and transported from ironwood. There was a wide gap between the two walls, the kill zone, in which invading enemies would be subjected to varied attacks from above, molten ore, boiling water, flaming arrows, and enormous boulders. All of this was explained to Rhone by Prince Gareth as they passed beneath the first gate and before they reached the second. Norris has been attacked twice, Gareth said. Once by the west when they managed to paddle upriver from the Bridge of Triumph and make landfall, and once by the north when they broke through Raiders Pass. At the mention of the west, Rhone's heart hammered. He was so close now. But he'd be even closer on the morrow. He needed to be patient for a while longer. Running his hands along the walls, Rhone inspected them for damage, but there was none save the occasional bit of chipped wood.
What happened?
The enemy breached the first wall, but then we slaughtered their armies in the kill zone, Gareth said. They retreated. Rhone couldn't help but to look up at the men and women patrolling the top of the inner wall. None smiled, despite the fact that the current invaders were friends, not foes, and each guard had a deadly glint in his or her eye. "You were here for those battles?" Rhone asked the prince. Gareth laughed. "I was still crawling," he said. "But the Juggernaut was here for both, weren't you, Dar?"
"Aye,"
the king said, bringing his muscular horse astride.
"Your mother was, too, before we were bonded. She was a red fern then, not an ironclad. Ah, you should have seen her then, son. She was a sight to behold, clad in body armor, her sword flashing as she felled soldier after soldier. Those were the days. I was but a prince seeking the glory of the kingdom and the eye of a beautiful woman. My brother and I fought back to back against a dozen foes and emerged victorious. He wielded this very ore hammer with more skill than any before him.
He held up a massive sledge that looked capable of smashing a skull to rock dust. Rhone was amazed that the king could even lift it, much less swing the blunt weapon. The handle was laced with exquisite metalwork, engraved in a strange language Rhone wasn't familiar with. It was a work of art. Rhone remembered the king's story about his brother, Corrin Thunder, Ironclad, and the sacrifice he'd made at the Razor. Seeing Gareth riding beside his brothers made Rhone look away. Knowing Gareth would one day sacrifice himself for his brothers wasn't something he wanted to think about.
"The foe hammer is a powerful weapon indeed," Gwendolyn said, joining the conversation.
She didn't look at Rhone.
"Thunder was a rare warrior."
Her comment seemed to please the king. Something occurred to Rhone.
"You were there, weren't you?"
he asked the Orion.
"At the battles at Norris. And at the Razor, too."
Her gaze remained firmly fixed ahead as they rode into a wide swathe of empty space inside the second wall.
"Yes," she said. "I have fought many battles and lived many lives. You are but a babe in comparison."
She spurred her horse and galloped ahead. The king leaned toward Rhone as he frowned after her.
If it's any consolation, we're all just children next to her years. She will outlive us all.
For some reason, the thought made Roan sad. Perhaps because the girl with the golden eyes and silver hair had seen so much.